Okay. Matthias has asked me to open this last session because he's busy doing like a million other things, like setting up for the concerts tonight, and I'll be glad to do that. Tonight's last session will be about mastering with Jamin, presented by Steve Harris, who is both one of the leading developers of Jamin. He's the guy who does all the digital signal processing, and of course he's known to users of Linux Audio through his very extensive LUTSPA plugins collection. So, enjoy, Steve Harris.
Okay, thanks. Right, so this talk is going to be about Jamin. originally I was going to talk about the... Sorry, is it possible? Originally, no. Sorry, I'm hearing a bit too much of my own voice, so it's hard to speak. Originally, I was going to talk about how the internals of Jamin work, but I decided just to cover the basic operation, what it does, a little bit on how to use it, although I'm not really the right person to talk about that, because I'm just a developer. I'm not a mastering expert or anything, but I can hopefully give you some usage hints and tell you what the different bits do and explain how it all works together. So, first of all, acknowledgements. There's a lot of people whose input into Jamin was vital for its success. In alphabetical order, there's Jan Deppner, who did a lot of the UI code documentation, particularly the high definition HQ, which we'll see in a while. There was Jack O'Quinn, who did a lot of the Jack IO code, which was very complicated for reasons I won't go into. Ron Parker wrote the docs, design advice, lots of user feedback. He's like the head user, if you like, and drives a lot of the requirements. And Patrick Shirky, who did more UI work and documentation. So this was a quote I got from Ron Parker when I asked him for some notes on what he thought mastering was. And this is what he came back with. I was going to read it out for the benefit of the people on IRC, but I can't see my laptop panel, so I just have to imagine it if it's not in the slides. So this is a slightly more succinct definition of mastering. There's a psychoacoustic phenomenon which you can sum up as louder is better. Humans perceive, if you've got two signals identical, one's a bit louder, humans will prefer the louder one. It's just a fact of life. You can exploit it, but it also causes problems. But in order to exploit it, that part of the mastering process, there's a series of gain stages is effectively what the louder part of mastering is. So it's a variety of different ways of increasing the perceived volume of the track, hopefully without distorting it too much. But in bringing up the sort of making everything louder, you can expose subtle problems that were hidden in the track earlier because they were too subtle. So it also includes a few things to help either hide or remove those problems that are that have been revealed by the extra gain. So the trick is to try and make it sound better without audibly distorting it, but better subjective. Some people don't like it or won't. It's an art. So the things that Jamin tries to do to help you, it's been very carefully designed to introduce the absolute minimum level of distortion, and it doesn't introduce any new hardly any noise into the system. If you the bits of the process that you're not actively using, like if you're not using EQ, nothing happens. If you're not using limiting, nothing happens. It's meant to be very transparent to preserve all the hard-fought recorded data. It's also being designed so that it doesn't introduce phase shift into the audio, so that the high and low frequency components are still the same relative timing as they were when they came into the application. There's some doubt as to whether that's important or not, but I did it that way anyway because a few of the more expensive products for Windows and Mac OS advertise that, and it seemed like we didn't want to miss a trick there. And without implementing it, you can't try it to know whether it makes a difference. And I haven't implemented the high phase shift equivalent to compare, so who knows. And it gives you a cohesive UI for handling your mastering tasks. You could do it all as a set of separate plugins. It would hurt performance slightly, and it would be really annoying to have to interact with all the separate plugin UIs, and it would just be harder. So it wraps out all the pretty much everything you need for the mastering processing into one UI. Right, it's not all good news. Jamming can make things worse. It takes a lot of CPU power. 500 meg P3s, sort of a reasonable estimate for a minimum machine to run it on. It's yet another thing to learn. You've got to learn Arda or whatever recording software you use as well, so it's one more thing. It does all its UI through Jack because it's a processing system. It doesn't do any disk I/O, so you're free to use whatever recording and playback tools you like to stream audio through it, and I'll show you some things about that later. But you still need to use other software to send audio through it or capture it, unless you're doing streaming from outside the PC and you're just using the PC to run Jamming, which is some people do. And you have to be careful because it's very easy to remove the essential vitality from a track by over-compressing it or over-limiting it. And it's not always obvious unless you're very careful with your bypass comparisons and checking to make sure it's not having too much of an effect on the dynamic range. So this is a diagram which shows the structure of Jamming, which helps to understand what it's doing. The far left is where the audio comes in, and the far right is where it goes out. So the first stage is just an input gain and balance control, which is just there to fix up any rough level changes that need to be made. Like when you're producing a series of tracks for a CD, it's necessary to make them sound well next to each other. So you make some of them quieter so that the end of that flows more naturally into the beginning of the next one. And just in case you have some balance problem, but generally that's already been fixed up at the mixing stage. Then you have the bypass control, which if you switch this on, the only thing that has any effect is input gain and balance control, and it just passes the output through a compensating delay through to the output. So when you hit the bypass button, you don't get any changes in tempo or anything, it just snaps over to being a very unprocessed signal. But it leaves this input gain and balance in there so that you can compare the effects of the dynamic range changes without changing the perceived amplitude, well, potentially. The next stage, and if this bypass is switched off, it has no effect, it just passes the audio through. Next steps is an EQ. It's a 1024 band EQ, which has got a number of interfaces to it to make. Obviously, you don't want 1024 sliders, that would just be a complete nightmare. So there's lots of different interfaces for interacting with that to get the effects you want. Then it goes into a crossover. This splits the signal into low, medium, and high bands, and you can control what the cutoff frequency is between the different bands. And then on each of these bands, there's a compressor and a stereo width. And until this morning, balance, but this morning it was removed from CVS because we decided that multi-band balance was just confusing and not useful for anything. So this is now just stereo width control, which allows you to, I'll explain what it does later. The next stage, all these three bands are mixed back to get the original signal, or something close to it, and it's fed into a limiter, which can be used to prevent any peaks of the signal going above 0 dB so that it won't clip, or sometimes to bring down the level. And it has some features which allow it to be used more subtly than you would expect from a limiter, to either to get more volume or just to make the volume consistent if it's a bit uneven playing, can be sort of leveled out a little bit. There's a boost, which is it's actually a distortion. I'm not really very fond of this as an effect, but if you absolutely need to make the track sound louder, this is a it's a combination of psychoacoustic tricks and just some simple distortion to make everything louder. I don't use it myself, but if you're doing certain styles of music, it might be appropriate. Then there's an output gain control, which is just a simple amplifier to another way of fine-tuning the level of the output signal to match other tracks. So this is what the UI looks like. kind of enormous on the screen. The different bits I've been talking about, here's the input gain and balance. This is one of the interfaces to the EQ. This is the control for the crossover. So here's the low band, here's the mid band. Sorry, can you see the laser pointer from the... I'm not sure how small it is, right. And here's the high band. From there, it comes down into the three compressors, and you have to ignore that. That's the one that's gone. This is a stereo width control. This is the compressor. From there, it comes up into the limiter and the boost control. There's the output. And the bypass is down here because, although it's actually at this place in the signal path, it's kind of more logical for it to be here. So this is showing the signal flow. It looks like kind of a weird path, but it's fairly logical when you're using the application. Someone suggested that this would be an alternative interface for jamming. yeah, maybe. The UI is designed to sort of expand on this bit. Hopefully it does that and doesn't help you go into this bit too much, but we'll see. So at this point, I'll just go through the UI components one by one, try and describe what they do, a little bit about how to use them. So this is the input gain and balance. It does exactly that. One thing that's worth noting is this is not a pan control. It's a balance control. A pan control mixes the left channel. If you've got a stereo pan, it mixes the left channel into the left and right channel and the right channel into the left and right channel. This just changes the relative amplitude of the left and right channel. So it doesn't pollute the opposite channel with signals from that channel. So it won't damage the stereo image or anything. It's just used for tweaking. If for some reason one channel is slightly higher and it's being emphasized later on in the processing. Sometimes if you've got a stereo recording, it sounds okay, but by the time you've processed it a lot, it emphasizes the difference between the tracks and starts to fix it up. But you hardly ever have to use it. It's just in there because it takes no CPU cycles and occasionally it's useful. Right, this is the main interface to the equalizer and the spectrum curve. This white line here represents the gain of the equalizer at different frequencies. And the pale green line in the background is the instantaneous amplitude of the frequency. So we've got a small peak in the low bands and then some peaks. I don't know what this noise is. I think it might be a guitar strum or something, but anyway. And it has scales in the background to show. These show half octaves, I think. And these red and blue lines are the crossovers, which gives you another way of controlling the crossover points, of the cut points of the crossover. So you can tune them relative to the frequency response. So if you see a particularly big peak in the middle here that you want to calm, you can move in those points around it and then use the compressors to tame it. The EQ curve can either be drawn directly with a mouse, so you just draw a curve, or you can use these parametric style controls here, which and another one here, where you pull apart the semicircles to increase the bandwidth and drag this middle marker up and down to change it from boost to attenuate. The range on this EQ is tiny. It's about 4 or 5 dBs, I think. You can increase it, but if you're doing more than 4 or 5 dBs of boost and cut at this stage, something's gone horribly wrong, and you don't need mastering. You need something else. So it's designed for very subtle, accurate tweaks to the frequency spectrum. This is the main crossover control. It's just paired exactly with the two stripes you saw earlier. The low band is the bass frequencies. Sorry, 0 Hz to low band is bass. The low to mid, which is this region, is the mid, and high to inf is treble. But you can tweak. I mean, you might, for example, want to have the low band really low and the high band really high, whatever, you can tweak them around. In practice, I don't find that I adjust this very much. The defaults are quite sensible, and it's not very often you need to make big changes. Right, these are the compressors. The bit that's grayed out at the bottom is a separate process. There are attack and release time controls, a threshold level, ratio control, a knee control, and a makeup gain. The attack time just controls the amount of time it takes the compressor to respond to an incoming peak. These compressors are a hybrid peak RMS, so they're neither one nor the other. They both take account of sort of slow swells that an RMS compressor will pick up, but they also try to stamp on instantaneous peaks in the input signal. I don't know quite how successful they are, but they can be tuned. Release is after a big peak that the compressors respond to, it's how slowly the effect decays away to allow the sort of natural sound to return. Threshold is the level at which the compressor starts to work. So if threshold's very low, it works on more of the signal. If you put it up to zero, it doesn't touch any of the signal at all. The ratio is how hard it compresses. So it goes up to about 20, I think, which is pretty high. If you have a very high ratio, it pretty much kills any peak that goes over the threshold value. And the makeup gain is used to, the function of a compressor is actually to bring down the levels of the signal, and the makeup gain boosts it back up again because we're trying to make things louder, or it's one of the things we're trying to do. So if you set it to auto, it tries to guess from the settings here what the correct makeup gain is to boost the signal for that band back up to the level it was when it came in. It's extremely complicated calculation, and it doesn't get it exactly spot on, but it's usually close enough for experimentation, and then you can take it off and tweak it by hand to get exactly the right balance. And this is repeated for all three. There's also a piece of UI which I think you get by control clicking on the sliders, which allows you to gang the sliders. So if you want to tweak the relative attack, or make relative attack changes to all bands, you can select them all and then move one, and the others will move in gang. So it makes it quicker for changing the settings globally. The oh, sorry, yes, I didn't explain that. That's the if you imagine the point at which the compressor goes from linearity, where it's not doing anything, to compressing, the sort of junction of that is called the knee. The knee control is the softness. If you set it to maximum, there's a 10 dB range either side over which it very gradually transitions from linear transfer to heavy compression, or mild compression, whatever kind of compression you're using. And if you set it to zero, it's a sharp angle. It's quite hard to explain the sonic effect, but if you have a very harsh knee, it tends to be the compression tends to be more of an audible effect. And if you say it's a very soft, it's a more subtle and natural sound. But it is something you have to play with to get the right kind of sound you're after. Right, this is the stereo width control. Ignore the thing below it. It allows you to change the perceived width of each band. So often you can, and it benefits you to narrow the stereo width of the bass controls, because there's not very much stereo perception in the bass controls, and it allows you to get more of a stereo impression from the higher frequencies sometimes. It effectively, if you've got a signal which is offset slightly from the center, if you increase this, it will move further away, and if you decrease it, it will move closer. There's also solo and bypass controls. Hitting solo mutes the other two bands, and allows you just to hear this one band with its compressor and effects running. And if you hit bypass, it cuts it out so that you can compare it back to the original signal. When you're doing this kind of subtle processing, it's very important to keep going back to the original signal to compare it, to make sure you're not losing detail or altering the sound in some way which isn't desirable. And after you've been listening to the processed signal for a long time, you can start to forget how it was supposed to be and get confused. This is the limiter. It's a look-ahead limiter, so it's looking at the signal that will be going through it in a second or so's time and responding to that. And so it slowly, if you've got a peak coming in at like plus 5 dBs in 1 second's time, over 1 second it ramps down the amplitude to bring that peak down under. So it can be extremely subtle. That's the release time there is what governs how quickly it transitions. If on the other hand you set it to a very fast time, you can use it to push, if you push signals beyond the limit, it will be a way of increasing the perceived volume at the cost of quite a lot of distortion. You might want to do it in some circumstances. And the limit control just is just the level at which it comes in. So if it's 0 dB, it will stop any signals going over 0 dB that might have been pushed up by the compressors or the EQ. And you can bring it down for various reasons. The boost, it's a distortion. if you want to distort your music, that's fine. Actually, if you use it in very tiny amounts, it's pretty inaudible, and it can sometimes make things sound better, but I wouldn't use it myself. It's there for feature compatibility. This is the scene control, which I forgot to mention earlier. Each of the settings that you see on the screen, in the sliders and so on, can be stored in a scene, which is kind of like a patch. And you can either use them for individual songs in an album, or verse chorus, or any parts of your song. And you can transition between them live to sort of emphasize some parts or subtly change the dynamics of different bits. The amber means it's the active scene, but you've made some changes since you recorded it. This dull red color means it's not being used. Lit green, this text is newer than this screenshot, which is why they don't agree. But I'll show you in the live thing, because I can't remember which one's quite correct. And you crossfade between them. If you select one of these, it crossfades between them. It's not actually true. I intended to add this OSC feature, but I haven't done it. I'll do it when I get home. You can send an OSC message to, or will be able to send an OSC message to Jamie, which causes it to change scenes. There's a Landspeed plugin you can embed in Arda, say, and you use Arda's automation to pick scenes at different times. So there's just a control port control. You set it to 1, it changes to scene 1, 2, scene 2, etc. So it means that you can do all your mastering sequencing inside Arda using automation editing, which is handy. Right. A little bit about the jamming philosophy. This is actually the Steve jamming philosophy, but no one objected on the mailing list, so I guess it's the jamming philosophy too. I don't think that users should be forced to make prints. Traditionally, when you're doing mastering, the mixing engineer produces a stereo print from the multi-track source, which you then feed into the mastering console. And there are some limits on that. For example, if you find that one of the drum tracks is a bit too high, you can either go back to the mix engineer and get to do another print, which is time-consuming, or you have to do something horrible with an EQ to pull down the frequencies that that drum's occupying. It's just not a very good idea. So it's a jack client so that it can be fed directly from a multi-track source, or you can, from another machine, even over SPDIF or whatever. And you're not required to produce stereo files, although if that's the way you prefer to work, you're perfectly free to. It's remotely runnable over X11, so that you can have the machine that's doing the processing in a different room from the machine that you're using to control the UI. I used to use this in my old studio for mastering in another room, which just had some speakers and an amplifier in it, and no PC. I ran a SPDIF cable. Should be minimum audio mangling. One of the things I intend to do is run some analysis over it to find out what the levels of total harmonic distortion and so on is. They're probably unmeasurable, but it's good to be sure. But it's designed to be very, very transparent in the audio sense, and no gimmicks. It's a tool. Shouldn't have stupid controls or pictures of valves that glow in time to the music. So, in the words of Bob Marley, now we have a demo. I think I'm going to have to switch back to the laptop panel, so the screen's going to go a funny shape. Okay. Right, so this is the user interface. It's got a session preloaded. You can't quite see the right-hand side of it. It's gone off the edge, but there's not an awful lot off that end anyway. There's also some transport controls at the top here, which say inject transport controls, which in theory saves you from switching back to your multi-track edge like Arda or whatever in order to, in order to start a transport. But in practice, Arda doesn't seem to sync to track transport. I don't know if Paul's here and he can confirm that, but it wasn't working earlier. Here's the EQ. Well, I can show you the EQ in action if I switch to a... if I just click and then I can draw whatever kind of EQ curve I need, click again to stop and it receives that. Just restore that back to the original settings. what else have I not demonstrated? Okay, and everything else is just standard GTK sliders and widgets, and you all know how those work. Oh, this this is how the parametric controls work. You can just drag them about. So if I switch over to Arda, this is hopefully a stable version of Arda, so I won't have the kind of problems Paul had. Right, this is the multi-track source of a project that Ron Parker did in his studio. Apparently the band that recorded this, it was recorded in Arda and mastered in Jamin, and on the strength of it they got a recording contract, so it can't be that bad. This is just the multi-track data. It's being mixed down to a master output there, which is fed directly to Jamin. Jamin's running in bypass at the moment. So you can see the that turns off a lot of the meters. You can see the input meters here and the output meters here, they should be the same. Although that meter's moving, this limiter's not doing anything. But you can hear what it sounds like. If I bring out the bypass, this is the mastering setup that Ron created for this particular track. In this case, the scenes are all for one individual track. So, in my through my headphones, it's a bit distinctive. You can see that he's using compressing fairly hard. The limiters are not used at all. It's quite a lot of boost, interesting. But the dynamic range has been squashed. Well, it's pushed it a lot higher up to zero, and the peaks have been squashed a little bit. I can switch to some of the other scenes and demonstrate the different subtleties of sound you can create. These are sessions created for other songs that help sound rock, just to show you the difference. This is one where it's got a cut frequency. I don't have the other songs. Can you hear the difference? It's a bit distinct from here. Wait, okay, I think that's... Right, that's all that I particularly wanted to demonstrate, but if anyone's got any questions or want to see anything in particular or see a particular unit in action, I'm happy to demonstrate any individual aspects of it. Oh, sorry, yeah. okay, so this is one of the alternative interfaces to the equalizer. This reflects the 1024 band as a IEC standard 33-channel graphic EQ. It's in there in case we ever add a text mode interface, because the HD EQ, there's no sensible way to interact with that through a command line or a console application. So this code's in there essentially so that it could be controlled through a cursor style interface. This is the equivalent IEC spectrum analyzer. It's tuned slightly wrongly, but it works. And this shows the transfer functions used by the compressors currently. So you can see that the mid-band's compressed harder. If you increase the makeup gain, you see it boosts the signal overall, increasing the ratio flattens it out. This version's got a bug, it doesn't render knees properly, but when you increase the knee, you see it becomes smoother and more round. This transfer function, this x-axis reflects the input amplitude of the signal, and the y is the output amplitude, that black line 0 dB. So in this case, it's pretty much linear here, and then once you go over this input amplitude, the output amplitude doesn't increase proportionally. Does that make sense? Okay. There's also some options. You can set preferences for the EQ, like where the readings are taken from. Where the readings from the spectrum are taken from, how often it updates, and the gain range and stuff like that. And it has a jack port GUI just for quickly connecting applications. So if I do that, it'll just pick stereo left and right and hook them to jamming inputs 1 and 2, just for convenience. Have you got the mic, Ian?
Hello there. Is this on? Doesn't sound like it. Oh, it is. Hello. just one question. The interface is very tightly packed with sliders and things.
Yep.
Are there any plans to make the individual parts of the interface relocatable, like put the input meter next to the output meter and dragging them around and stuff?
No. Your observation that's tightly packed is very accurate. We spent a lot of time playing around with it to try and keep the relative positions of the UI components logical while still fitting it on a reasonable screen size. You can see it only just fits in 1024768. And a lot of people have laptops at that resolution, so we don't really want to go beyond that limit unless we can really help it. And reordering the components would kind of imply changing the signal path, and although the block diagram made it look nice and neat, actually it's intermingled in an extremely complicated way, and changing the order is not really practical, and it would alter the sound. The things like the crossover and the EQ are very closely meshed together, and it's not really as separated as that diagram made it look.
So we listened to a quite impressive mastering process now, but I would wonder, I mean, we listened to it. How do you store it on a disk? Would you feed it back to Arda to record another track? Or
yes.
Can you record with the program itself? Or the second question would be, would it be usable as a kind of insert or plug-in in Arda as a kind of a master strip or something like that?
Yes. The original session that Ron mailed me here, you can see that there's underneath the master, there's a jamming return, which is what he recorded it back to. There's jamming actually introduces an awful lot of latency due to the way it does the processing, and but Jack can compensate for that. So you end up with the original signal time aligned with the process signal inside Jack, and you just treats like another stereo ADA pair, which you can export or whatever you need to do with it. That's kind of how we typically envisage people would use it, recording back into ADA. It doesn't have any recording capability itself, because that's kind of, it's a one do one thing well type tool. But you can hook it up to any Jack recording system. Is there another question? Sorry, I've forgotten. That was it, okay. Oh yeah, insert, yes you can. But it eats a lot of CPU, like, at the moment, this is running at 1.2 gigahertz, and it's taking 30% of the CPU, so you're not going to run very many of them. We've had some interest from people who want to use it as a multiband compressor for radio broadcast, because they have similar problems. It's not exactly the same, but similar.
First of all, I'd like to say in the control elements, I think it's a good solution. I used hardware 90-inch machines in the past, and a friend of mine uses those Waves plugins and VST. You have to use several of them, and they don't fit in one screen, so I think it's a good solution.
Thanks.
Just one question, how much time was used to make the development, and which development environment did you use, native C or?
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting question. It started quite a long time ago. It was actually Jörn's fault, because he pointed out how badly mastered some of my music was. So I started working on a multiband compressor and some stereo fixing problems to sort some of the horrendous problems. And I naively tried to do a very bad, I'm the world's worst UI programmer, like by a long shot. And I tried to bolt my own UI onto it, and it was just dreadful. And I think at that point, Jan Deppner saw it and was horrified and decided to fix it. But the development environment is it's Glade, actually. So this is all done in a drag and drop GUI builder thing. Obviously, this is hand drawn, but all the sliders and stuff are just done in Glade, in C. It's a GTK2 application. Glade grinds a bit. This is the amount of code it generates to build this UI is ridiculous. But it works, and it means that at the time none of us knew GTK, so it was a really good way to get into it and play. And it means you can move UI elements around quite easily to try out what effect it has on the usability. I started working on the multiband compressor maybe 18 months ago, I think, something like that. No, probably more than that. I really have no idea. More than a year and less than three. There's a lot of man hours went into it. It's a pretty enormous piece of code inside. But a lot of the, something I didn't point out is that these compressors, the limiter, and a few other things are LADSPA plugins that are loaded when the application loads. So that stuff, one, you can use it externally in your own application, exactly the same effects. And two, that saved a lot of development time because I didn't have to rewrite all that code. I just pulled it out of, just used the LADSPA plugin directly. Yep.
Normalization.
Normalization, yeah. You mean like peak normalization? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a normal time process. But I don't know, is Ron on IRC? But I think Ron said that he didn't find much use for it as a mastering tool. Okay. Because it doesn't take any account of loudness, it only takes account of peaks, and there's not very much relation between the two.
Okay. I just wondered why it hadn't been included. But
yeah, it's not actually, you can't do it in real time. Yeah, but even if you could, I don't think it would. That's kind of what the look-ahead limiter does over a constrained time period, in a sense.
Any more questions? Yeah, maybe we take from one from IRC first.
Hi, this is Sebastian again. Like Luke Jelovic asks, does the current design of Gemin allow the possibility for another interface to be written for it?
Yeah, it does. Well, like I said, we have a half plan for Curtis interface, and a couple of people have asked for a headless version that runs without X. You can just load it as a without any UI at all, you just load a save file of scenes. Although the UI and the DSP code live in the same process, they're actually separated by a very rigid API, which is necessary to make the transitions between scenes smooth. It kind of crossfades gradually between scenes when you make the changes. And as part of that, there's a rigid separation between the code paths, even though there's not IPC or anything in there. It's a C API, but there's a separation. But in practice, pulling out the GTK-ness would be hard. But adding something else wouldn't.
Okay, maybe, there's another couple of questions.
I just wonder what the internal resolution of Gemin is. Is it the same as the source material, or do you take it to like 32 bits or 24?
It's mostly 32-bit float. There's a bit of 64-bit. That's part of the stuff about not dropping any resolution. No, it's the primary concern when building it was making sure that it doesn't make things worse unless you tell it to make things worse. So if you set everything to neutral and run a signal through, it should go through basically unmodified. that's the ideal anyway. Like I said, I mean to write some software for measuring that stuff and haven't done yet, but certainly by ear, I mean, I've spent a lot of time testing it and making sure it doesn't induce any audible artifacts.
Can you push down the all-in-all latency, so to say, to have a real-time application for DJ environment and stuff?
Yeah, kind of. You could, if you remove the look-ahead limiter, that would help. And if you changed it so that the EQ is done a different way, the EQ is done with a Fourier transform, which is an inherently high latency operation. You can burn, if you double the CPU, you can half the latency, but you don't want to do that too much. But if we, you could, the thing is, if you do that, basically what you end up with is a multi-band compressor. And the multi-band compressor is it's a fine thing to have, but you don't need the rest of Jamming, just if you just want multi-band compression. Someday I'll write one for Lads, but it only take me like a day or something. It's just like not at the top of the list.
So shouldn't there be some dithering algorithm if you're using 32-bit material and want to master for a CD, for example?
Yeah, but that's not Jamming's problem. Although, having said that, one of the things I'm going to add in the near future is a dither control on the output, because certainly the way I use it, I feed the output of Jamming to the monitors and the output of Jamming back to Ada or wherever I'm recording it. And it's certainly potentially important that you hear the same dithering algorithm as is being used when you burn the CD. Because, you know, you're tweaking it according to what you're hearing coming out of the monitors, and if that's not dithered in the same way, it alters the sound. So there will be an option to dither the output of Jamming somewhere in the next few months. what it would require is a standardization of the dither algorithms used in Linux Audio, and that's not currently there. Although, as far as I know, all the dithering algorithms that are used in Linux Audio were written by me. They're not all the same. So one thing I plan to do is go around and rip it out of all the applications that have got it, write a very simple library to implement it, put the library calls back in, so that you can say, if you pick the algorithm and the bit depth in Jamming, it will sound the same as when Ada does it, or Audacity, or whatever else.
Any other really pressing questions? Apparently not. Anything from IRC? Well, Steve, is that it?
Yep, I think so.
Well, okay. Then let's close the session. Thank you very much, Steve Harris. And if you still have time, there's going to be a number of concerts in the Kubus tonight, and we'd be happy to welcome there. Bye.